Sick Boy Podcast is a health and comedy show about what it's like to be sick. Wait, is that right? How can illness be funny?
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Sick Boy is hosted by
me, Brian Stever.
And me, Taylor McGilvery.
And myself, Jeremy Saunders.
Come on in and join us to melt your heart, learn something fascinating, and bust a belly laugh. Trust us, you'll be glad you did.
You can find Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your pods.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. I want to play you a little bit of one of the most famous pieces of music of the 20th century. What you're listening to right now is George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, one of the most famous pieces of North American classical music. This year marks 100 years of that piece of music. It was performed for the first time on February 12th, 1924 in Manhattan. It was this groundbreaking fusion of classical and jazz, which was really just kind of starting out as a genre. And it really captured the energy and the mixing of cultures that was happening in New York in the early 20s. So as you might expect with this piece turning 100 this year, there's been a lot of reflection on the work, including by Bela Fleck, widely regarded as one of the greatest banjo players of all time, the guy who really took the instrument from being associated with like hee-haw and country and bluegrass, took it to the worlds of jazz and classical music and funk. I'll tell you this, when I was 17, my buddies were really into like Sloan and Jimi Hendrix and Doug Gilmour, and I was super into Bela Fleck, so as you might imagine, I got a lot of dates. Anyway, this year, Bela released an album titled Rhapsody in Blue, which sees Bela playing different versions of the Gershwin piece. Bela calls that piece Rhapsody in Bluegrass. That's his adaptation of Rhapsody in Blue for Bluegrass Band. Bela dropped by our CBC Ottawa studio while he was in the nation's capital, and we got into it about the record, about his relationship with Rhapsody in Blue, how and whether it holds up as a piece of music, and a new project that comes out this Friday, which is a duet album from Bela with the late, great, legendary jazz piano player Chick Corea. Plus, some of the best filibustering you've ever heard on this show. Here's our conversation. Congratulations on the album. I really loved it. When did you first hear Rhapsody in Blue?
I can't give you a date, but I'm going to guess somewhere around 7, something like that. But it really could have been anywhere between 5 and 8. But my uncle took me to see the Rhapsody in Blue movie, which was, you know, black and white movie, very romantic. Romanticization, I can't say that today, but of George Gershwin's life, and including him dying very young. And then that music came on, and I just fell in love with it. And it's stayed with me, you know. Just it doesn't go away, because you're gonna run into it throughout your life. And every time I'd hear it, I'd always love the themes, and you know, yeah, nice songs, but the piano playing would always knock me out. I go, gosh, I wish I could play that. I want to play the piano part of Rhapsody in Blue someday. And every time I'd mess with it a little bit, it'd be like, ain't gonna happen, dude. It's too hard. There's no way to do this. Another interesting little element, I'll blabber here for a second and block you from questioning me.
You're smart. It's like you're at Congress, Bela. That's very smart of you.
Yeah, that's how we do
it. Filibustering. This is great.
Exactly. Take control of the interview right at the top. But Abigail, my wife, went to Colorado College, and one of her pals there that graduated with her is a guy named Ryan Benally, and he ended up writing a book about Rhapsody in Blue called Arranging Gershwin. And when Abby did the commencement speech there, he gave it to me. And I met him, and he was a cool guy, and I took the book, and I thought, oh, cool, I always loved this piece. And I read the book, and it fired me up, you know, even more about the piece, and just learning all these details about George Gershwin writing at the last minute. I mean, there's the lore is that he forgot he was supposed to write it, and then it was 3 weeks before the piece, and he was like, oh my gosh, I better write that thing so it's ready.
No way, really?
Yeah. And in fact, I think he had some gigs. I think he had to run up to Boston for something, so he had to take the train up to Boston. And the train, the sound of the train apparently influenced, I can't remember which part, but there's some part in the piece that was you know, influenced by the sound of the train as he was sitting there, I guess probably riding on the train, because he turned it around very quickly. To finish the story, I did finish figuring out how to play the piano part of the original piece, the orchestra version, and made plans to play it with an orchestra. And as I got to know it, I was out on tour with my Bluegrass Heart band, which is Sierra Hull, Michael Cleveland, Brian Sutton, Justin Moses, Mark Schatz. So for folks out there, just some of the cream of the crop of young, mostly younger, younger than me, bluegrass, you know, virtuosos. So I went ahead and made plans to record the symphony version where I would play the piano part with a symphony, a typical symphony. But somebody pointed out to me, hey, well, that's only 18 minutes long. What are you going to do for the rest of the record? I was like, and this weird little voice came in my head and said, Rhapsody in Bluegrass. And I said, no, go away, voice. This is a terrible, terrible thing we would do to this poor piece. But no, but it kept coming back and each time a little louder. And so I gingerly knocked on Brian Sutton's door and said, would you play this with me for a few minutes and just see if there's anything here? Because I just don't want to make a horrible bluegrass version. Because there are a lot of bluegrass covers of things.
Yeah, pretty rough.
And yeah, sometimes, I mean, I don't know why they have to be bad, but generally they're a little bit hee-haw.
Yeah.
So my thing was, could we bring something to this piece that would be unique and special? And, you know, what you just heard is just the introduction. It starts going and we really get into a bluegrass groove and everybody gets to go crazy. But we also try to respect the piece and really play the melodies right and get the most important pieces of it and see how we can make it fit the groove.
As I mentioned, it's the 100th anniversary of Rhapsody in Blue. And so I read this piece you sort of wrote about Rhapsody in Blue around the same time as the record came out. So I should say to people who don't know, in the New York Times, there was this jazz musician named Ethan Iverson. He's a member of the Bad Plus. And you read this piece where he called Rhapsody in Blue the, quote, worst masterpiece.
Yeah.
But then goes on to make some really interesting points about the appropriation of black music in Rhapsody in Blue, talking about Gershwin borrowing heavily from black jazz musicians at the time, these musicians not getting the recognition they deserved at that time. How did you feel when you read that piece while working on this?
I was a little bugged and I was like, oh, come on, do we have to trash this piece? It's such a great piece. There's so much I loved about it. And finally, I went back and reread it a few times and realized he really was quite respectful about it. What he was frustrated about were there was a number of valid concerns, which is that if you are skirting that area of jazz meets classical, that piece was such a powerful roadblock to future pieces. Because it was so good, it was so catchy, because George Gershwin, above all else, was a great songwriter, a great tune writer. So, I mean, whether it was put together the way Beethoven or Mozart might have put together a concerto, no, you know, that wasn't his expertise. He had never done it before. So at any rate, but what I just wanted to say is that I had an experience with it as a child that I don't want to deny, or I don't think you should have to. And I think what George Gershwin did was he was respectful to where a lot of the ideas came from. He didn't say, hey, I created this whole thing. He was like, no, I love jazz. I love what the black musicians are doing, and I want to find a way to bridge this gap with this piece, this concerto. So he was very respectful of the origins of where a lot of the ideas came from, and that helps. Like if someone pretends they made it all up, that's creepy, you know?
Yeah.
But I just had to write from my perspective that I don't think we have to blame the piece or be upset when an artist goes outside their world, studies something, and is changed by something they hear from another culture and brings it back and does their own thing with those ideas. I just would hate if we were afraid to be creative and put all kinds of constraints on natural creativity. Because I know whenever I hear something new from another place, whether it's within my culture or without, it opens up my mind to new possibilities, and I immediately want to create and do new, you know, create new music. And it, but it's still my music, it's still coming out of me. I'm not, I don't try to copy it, but I love it, that moment when everything seems different and I see a new pathways. And I know that's what happened with him, because that's how it works. So anyway, I just thought we didn't have to blame him or blame the piece, but we could blame our culture, if you want, you know, for the way fame works or the way pieces become successful, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I was really interested in the piece that you brought up your own experience there. There was a quote that came out, and you know, I've talked about this before. You wrote, as a white man playing the banjo, an essentially African invention falsely branded as a white bread instrument as it traveled through the 1900s, everything I do moves within the problematic nature of the harm done along race lines throughout American history. Talk to me about that. You wanted to bring sort of your own instrument's experience into this essay.
Well, it's a struggle with the banjo being branded like that way, but, and largely by, now this is another example of fame. Like if Earl Scruggs wasn't so great, we wouldn't all think of the banjo as a white Southern instrument. But he was just so good. And it swept everything else away, and then there were some major media things that happened that cemented that even further, and to the point that nobody, even black folks that I know, if I ask them, you know, hey, where do you know where this instrument, even in Africa, hey, you know where this instrument comes from? No, Tennessee? No, it comes from Africa, it comes from West Africa. So I just, and I guess because I'm not from the South myself, although I love the music that Earl Scruggs and Bill Monroe created and has grown so much into so many different wonderful directions. I love that so much, and I'm glad to be a part of it. I'm not from that part of the country, so I guess for me it makes it was a real question mark for me why I played this instrument for so long, until I found out, you know, the history, and that, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it was the instrument. The guitar wasn't here yet, and everybody played the banjo, and all kinds of people did. And then there's all kinds of history about the, you know, arguments about whether you should only play primitive music on it or whether you could, for instance, play Bach on it. Back in like late 1800s, these kinds of arguments, play classical music. And they did. They had banjo orchestras. Banjo was in the birth of jazz. And most people don't remember that unless you point it out. And go, what instruments were in Louis Armstrong's first band? And they think about it, and I say, banjo, right? And they say, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know.
Play that thing, Mr. Simpson, a lot. You know you can do it. Everybody from your knees can really do that thing. Hey, hey.
But I, you know, that's pretty important too. But it got excised from jazz because of all of the minstrels, which would be white folks painting themselves black, playing banjos and singing about how great it is on the plantation.
Yeah.
That's really a very distasteful thing for someone who was recently freed from slavery to hear, as a black people, you know, were in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and earlier, when the minstrels were popular. And it was just very offensive. So when there was a chance for the banjo to be deleted from jazz, it was yes, let's get rid of that old thing, dump it. And yeah, guitar came in and it was just gone. And it was as if it was never there.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Coming up, more of my conversation with banjo virtuoso Bela Fleck.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Tom Power, you're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with Bela Fleck.
the multi-Grammy-winning banjo player, widely regarded as the greatest living five-string banjo player. Bela's latest album is called Rhapsody in Blue. It features various takes of by Bela and his band of the George Gershwin classic Rhapsody in Blue, including this one you're listening to right now, which is called Rhapsody in Bluegrass. Funky. Bela has another album coming out this Friday with the late and legendary jazz piano player Chick Corea. Chick died in 2021, but this new album called Remembrance features Chick and Bela playing some tunes together near the end of Chick's life. So Chick also has a connection to Rhapsody in Blue. That all began because of a phone call from the very famous Chinese virtuoso piano player Long Long. Anyway, I wanted to get that story from Bela Fleck. Here's what he told me.
We were on a tour bus going through Europe, doing a duo tour of Europe, and which was just such, imagine that, me on a tour bus with Chick Corea going to play duo concerts in the biggest, most beautiful concert halls of Europe. How did that happen? You know, that. But so anyway, we're riding down the road and he gets a phone call and he gets interested. So I'm looking to see, oh, who's he talking to, you know? And he gets off and he said, well, that was Lang Lang. I said, really? And he said, yeah, he wants to know. He's got a bruised paw, like one of his hands wasn't working well. Yeah. So he was getting people to help him by playing the other hand of some pieces. And he had an opening night at Carnegie Hall. And he asked Chick if he would play, I'm assuming the right hand. I'm not sure. But I'm assuming he was playing the right hand of Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, wow.
And so Chick said, I'm trying to decide. Yeah, I don't know whether I should do it or not. I said, well, Chick, I just happen to have read a great book by this guy, Ryan Benally. And it talks about how many ways that Rhapsody in Blue has been rearranged and replayed. And I said, if I were you, like Chick Corea needs my permission.
Yeah.
But like if I were you, I would take it to the moon.
Yeah.
Because you know how to do it. And he was like, let me think about that. And so then all of a sudden he had decided to do it. And when I'd get to soundcheck, you know, he'd be in the dressing room and I'd hear him working on it. You know, he'd be working on Rhapsody in Blue.
Wow.
And he'd be, and then I'd walk in and, or he'd be on stage doing soundcheck and he'd say, yeah, Bela, I think what George was trying to do in this section was this.
Wow.
So anyway, the piece went off and it happened and I happened to read a review about it and it was actually panned. After all of that, they stomped all over it and said, you know, like, what a terrible idea. But I thought, well, I wish I could hear that. And it wasn't until recently I found out that it was recorded. He went and did it in Sardinia with an orchestra there, and he really changed it a good bit. And you just hear him Chick Corea-ifying the Rhapsody piece, and that was just a wonderful thing to find out.
I mean, how did you end up? I mean, people who know you from bluegrass will know you from bluegrass, but people also know you from your from playing jazz over the years and with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. But how did I even remember? I remember when that Chick Corea collaboration first came out between you guys, and it really kind of surprised me. Like, how did that come about? How did you guys end up working together?
Well, I was a big fan. I heard him when I was first time when I was 17 with Return to Forever, the seminal. The biggest version of the band was playing the Beacon Theater in New York City. And I went to the show and blew my mind. And it was the template of everything I've ever done since. Like seeing this four-piece band filling up the hall with sound, different racial vibe, every single person a supreme virtuoso. I was like, wow, I want to play in a band like that someday with my banjo.
Yeah. You know,
17 years old,
good
whatever.
Luck.
Yeah, good luck. But I did write him a note. I sent a note. There was an address, I think, on the back of his records for correspondence. So I was like, I wrote him a fan letter, and he wrote me back. And then so over the years, I would always be listening to everything he did. And occasionally, maybe I even made it backstage to say hello. As I got further along as a banjo player, I had more sort of chutzpah. But at some point, we were at the Grammys with the Flecktones, one of the first times we were nominated. And so was he. And one of the really nice things about the Grammys is they would have this meeting of all the nominees. But not everybody goes. Some people are too cool to go. But a lot of the musicians like us would go. So anyway, we hooked up with Chick. We sat together in the pre-awards, and we got to watch him go up and win. Well, we didn't, but it was really nice. It was really nice. So
yeah,
I was on his radar.
I get it, yeah.
Right, it was awesome. Yeah. So I was on his radar a little bit. I knew that because we had a really friendly, fun time. And so I thought, well, I'm going to ask him if he'll play on something. And I did. And he said yes. And he played on an album called Tales from the Acoustic Planet, Volume 1. He played on three tracks, and they went great. And I went, you know what? I'm never going to bother this guy again. I've gotten all I deserve. So a few years later, I'm at a jazz festival. Chick's booking agent, Ted Curlin, walked up to me. He said, I was looking for you. He said, Chick Corea is thinking about doing some duet partner work next year with maybe three different duet partners. And he was wondering if you might be interested. You're on the list. And I was like, yes. And so I think because I was the first he ran into and because I showed so much enthusiasm, we just went ahead and did that and got together and made that record very quickly. With almost literally, I mean, the only rehearsal was running through a few melodies the night before in the hotel and not all of them, and then recording it in just, I think, 3 days. And that's The Enchantment. And I can't quite imagine how it turned out so well, honestly, because we were so unprepared.
There are Chick Corea recordings that didn't see the light of day. Is this right with you?
So the last tour we did together, I'm thinking it was 2019. It was, you know, the spring before the pandemic. We went out on tour, and we'd been doing that music from the Enchantment CD for 10 years now or longer. I can't even say. And every once in a while, I'd bring out a new tune and throw it at him at soundcheck. He'd say, "Yeah, that's nice." He'd say, "That's nice. But let's just do the gig. But this time, it had been so many years. And finally, I got in touch with him before the tour and said, "Hey, Chick, I'm going to bring three or four new pieces. I just think it would be fun." And he said, "Okay, well, then I will too." So on that last tour, which was a couple weeks long, we played all new, like a, 9 new pieces that we'd never played before. And that was fine. At the end of the tour, I said, "Hey, Chick, I'll come down to Florida anytime and we can lay this stuff down in your studio." And he said, "We just did. And you're the producer."
Oh, my God.
And so he's like, "Go listen to that stuff and tell me what we got." And so we started this whole pandemic games procedure where we not only did we send tunes back and forth, we also would send musical games. "Here, I'm going to play for a couple of minutes till I run out of steam, and then I'm going to stop. Then I'm going to send it to you. Then you play for a while, and then send it back to me." Like run-on games.
Wow.
Or musical games.
Like with your hero, man.
Yeah.
Like, this is crazy. This is wild. Yeah, yeah.
It was so fun. And we ended up with all this material, and pretty much, not pretty much, everything he was signed off on and loved and said, "Great, we got this in the bag. This album's done." And then he disappeared. This was like around November of that year. And I couldn't get a hold of him. And I could just tell something was wrong because up until then he was always, you know, you send him a note, boom, he'd be back with busy, can't chat now, or he'd be, you know, he liked to text, he liked to emoji, he was just sort of very available. Suddenly he was not available, and I was like, something's up.
Yeah.
So, and when I asked about it, is everything okay? He said, "Just some silly human problems." That's what he said.
Wow.
And then I didn't find out till the day they announced it that he had died. I was like, oh, I knew something was up, but...
I mean, it must change the way you're listening back to this music.
You know, there's a certain way that it doesn't. It's like he's still alive. He's alive to me, like because there's his voice. There's his, you know, all these things that I have, all these experiences, these things that are all still in my phone. You know, and he's just right there. He's just alive as can be. So maybe he is somewhere. You know.
Yeah.
And so mostly I like to celebrate him and be proud that I got to share his airspace and provoke some different things out of him. Because I think I didn't ever feel like I could play at his level, but I did feel that he would play different things due to my instigation. And I thought that was something to, that's an accomplishment of mine, to get some different stuff out of Chick Corea that maybe wouldn't have been heard any other time. So that's something.
Well, I'm excited to hear it. We're going to go out in the piece Remembrance. Bela, thanks so much for making the time for us today, especially on a gig day.
Hey, thanks for giving me the time. I really appreciate it. It's always lovely to talk to you.
Remembrance by Bela Fleck and the late Chick Corea off the album of the same name that comes out this Friday. Before that, my conversation with
my high school hero there, Bela Fleck. We were also talking about his record that is out now, Rhapsody in Blue. It's an album that includes Bela's bluegrass and orchestral versions of the classic George Gershwin work. That's it for the show today. The other conversation we put up today is with Carly Fortune, the best-selling romance novelist, a Canadian romance novelist, who, and I love this story, because I don't know, I feel like you might relate to this. She had a really bad day at work. She got up a really demoralizing Zoom call and decided she needed to make a change, and she wrote the book that would change her life. She'll tell you that story. Go check that out wherever you got this podcast. We'll see you soon, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.